Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the senior editors of the world's leading libertarian magazine gather each week to talk about what's happening. And sadly, I don't mean the TV show. Yak, yak, yak. I'm Matt Welsh, joined by my Reason colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, people who are both older and younger than Tom Brady. Catherine doesn't know what that means.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt. Pour one out for Rerun. If we're going the what's happening line.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, Rog, you're wearing the Rog glasses.
I think this is going to be the Super Bowl of podcasts.
At the very least, it is going to be the Superb Owl of podcasts, which was a thing that the internet kept telling me I should care about yesterday.
Did that happen
in
previous years?
I saw
a lot of Superb Owls, and it's like I was seeing so many owls in my Twitter feed, and I was like, oh, that's weird that everyone decided about owls today. And then I realized it was Superb Owl, and then I got kind of... We used to hear on Twitter, it used to be all about the Last Man game. You remember that? That was
the whole thing. Puppy Bowl.
Well, you know, Matt, I think yesterday's Super Bowl was about getting back to the middle.
Oh, God.
In a Jeep. By a guy from New Jersey in Kansas, because his shittiest album is called Nebraska. It all makes sense.
Nebraska's
you just need
a great album.
Dakota Ring.
Watch your mouth. But I think that the one thing America suddenly agreed on, like we all came together in saying enough, Bruce Springsteen. Like I didn't see a single person. I don't think even Eric Alterman did a fist pump when that happened. Okay, we're already off the rails here. We're supposed to be talking about the Biden administration and their policy machinery, which is beginning to whir in the night and during the day. But before all of that, our friends at the libertarian law firm, the Institute for Justice, have a great podcast that you should listen to called Bound by Oath. There they take a look at how and why governments and their employees can violate people's constitutional rights. And explore the stories of those individuals who fought back, along with the lawyers who helped them out, legal scholars who can explain it all in English. You can find Bound by Oath wherever podcasts are widely available. Download it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Suderman, Computerman, can you give us a status report of what the heck is going on with the $1.9 trillion Mr. Magoo sandwich of Corona stimulus relief, whatever? Now, minimum wage, Joe Manchin, and whatnot.
Yeah, so Joe Biden campaigned on a $1.9 trillion COVID recovery plan. Actually, he campaigned on several plans. So that's part one of two, and we don't know what part two is going to be yet. But you can assume that it's going to be $1 trillion plus. It's probably going to do healthcare and a bunch of other stuff. It's supposed to be the kind of after we get out of the coronavirus recession, let's reset America and do all that sort of stuff. In any case, he campaigned on $1.9 trillion worth of stimulus, recovery money, aid, relief, whatever you want to call it. It's a big pot of money that sends, as I have said before, a lot of money to everyone, to teachers, to individuals, to families, to business owners, to the healthcare system for rolling out vaccines and sort of getting infrastructure for that sort of stuff set up. And it's a really big package. And I think that's something that we just sort of should stop and emphasize here, because Biden himself is emphasizing that one of the virtues of this, his argument for this for $1.9 trillion is we need something gigantic. We need to really step in with a bold, big package. And it's kind of interesting when you listen to Biden and this sort of Biden world talk about this, how little they're actually talking about what's in it. They're just talking about the sheer bigness of it as the virtue and the necessity of doing something that is gigantic. And they're doing something that is so big that I think it's notable that the center left economic world is actually getting cold feet here. And so you have seen Larry Summers notably, but even more than that, Olivier Blanchard, who is who is notably an economist who gave a big speech just a couple of years ago saying, you know what? Interest rates are low. They've been notably low for a long time. We should borrow more. Money is so cheap that, in fact, borrowing is great and it will help the economy. And that's sort of that's where the center of macroeconomic theory is at. And those folks are saying, whoa, wait a minute. We just did $4 trillion worth of relief, stimulus, whatever you want to call it, last year. We see in the coming year a need for a big package. It's true, a big relief package. They are saying somewhere on the order of $500 to $800 billion, which is really pretty significant by any historical comparison. But $1.9 trillion actually runs the risk of overheating the economy. And it's really kind of interesting to see here that the left is split on this. And the left is actually the sort of, I think, the responsible folks who you could characterize as definitely not fiscal hawks, but fiscal doves, right? People who think the deficit doesn't matter that much all the time. On the other hand, they don't believe it's a non-constraint at all, and they don't believe that there is an essentially unlimited amount of money that we can borrow and spend to do whatever we want at any time. And that is basically where the Democratic Party has gone in the space of a year, is that they are now basically operating under the premise that there's no real limit to how much we can borrow and spend, and that we can keep doing $1.9 trillion packages, you know, forever to buy whatever we want with them. Maybe not Medicare for all, but pretty much anything short of that. And so it's just become a kind of an interesting technocratic policy debate in which even the folks who a year or two ago were on the bleeding edge of saying, actually, now's the time to borrow. Let's do that. Let's spend more and borrow more, are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, this is way too much.
Nick, to follow up on that, like, it's not hard to imagine that infection rates are going down, hospitalizations going down. Pretty soon deaths are going to be going down from the
Matt,
the
are
pandemic.
You about to call the coronavirus a hoax? Because if you are, would you just skip ahead? Stop the throat clearing?
No, the throat clearing is as follows. Most people forecast after the dark clouds go away that the economy is going to boom because people are going to get back to work. Is there an argument for, like, we don't need a stimulus? We don't, or, you know, what, we don't need a relief bill? Like, nature can heal.
Yeah, I think actually there's a very strong argument for that. And I believe it was in something that Peter Suderman wrote at Reason, but, basically more than half of families of households making between $50,000 and $150,000 have seen no decline in income during the pandemic. They should not be getting extra money. Peter is right that among the Democratic Party, and I would argue there's a distinction to be made between liberals, who is somebody like Blanchard, somebody like Larry Summers, a kind of centrist liberal, and more progressive people, you know, that are in the Bernie Sanders camp and are and Elizabeth Warren, to a large degree, the economists kind of supporting them, who are basically like, money's cheap, let it rip. But that debate is going on, and it takes on real urgency because they control Congress, essentially. Democrats control Congress. So how they resolve that is going to have a big effect on the rest of us. But the larger argument and the better argument is that we went into this with an economy that was doing pretty well. It could have been doing better if they followed more libertarian prescriptions on things like, regulation. If we got rid of Trump's stupid tariffs, many of which are going to survive the Biden administration and his Buy American provisions and all that kind of crap. But, you know, we had an economy that was at least working, and it's going to come back. I think the argument that we need to be making here is, one, you cannot pump a massive, like an incalculable amount or an unimaginable amount of money into the economy in a short period of time and not expect it to have weird effects that we might not see. The main point of government here isn't to superheat the economy or anything. It's to help people who are hurting. We can do that in a targeted way that's not going to cost $1.9 trillion every time Joe Biden sees a dip in approval ratings.
Catherine, I know we talked about the issue of minimum wage recently, a week or two back, but it's part of this too. And the proposal is to attach a $15 minimum wage to this corona relief bill. We've had a piece on the site talking about how that might violate the rules governing reconciliation measures in the Senate, which is a bit arcane.
The bird rule, man.
Thank you.
The bird rule that that
the Larry Bird rule
that governs reconciliation.
The Big Bird rule.
And you have to deal with
it's
bills.
It's the Mark the Bird Fidrich rule, Nick.
Do you know that Big Bird was in the Ku Klux Klan back in the 1950s, Matt?
Isn't that a tall tale, Nick?
Explains everything. Catherine, can you just briefly reflect on the madness?
On where your life went wrong that you're on this podcast right
we're
now.
We're like Catherine, 13 minutes into this podcast. I'm just sitting here. We've gone
Catherine,
Big Bird.
Do you have the Diet Coke button under yeah. your desk,
no,
except that it shuts Nick and Peter up? No, can you just talk about, reflect on the madness of even proposing to attach a $15 federal minimum wage into a coronavirus relief bill?
I think there's a point where declaring any individual provision in this madness an exercise in closing all of the doors after the horses are running free or something. I don't know, Matt. It's been that kind of week for me already, and it's Monday morning.
Big Bird left the barn.
You know, We are using the coronavirus as an excuse at this point to do a lot of things that people wanted to do anyway. And the $15 minimum wage is a classic example of that. The fight for 15 long predated coronavirus. It will, God willing, postdate it because we won't actually do it right now. Bernie Sanders says there's a room full of lawyers working overtime to make the case for the $15 minimum wage is a CNN headline that I was looking at a few days ago. So I have no doubt those lawyers will be doing their best. But we, as we've discussed on this podcast, are wedging all kinds of stuff into coronavirus response, including just massive, massive amounts of infusion of cash. It's not clear that that cash is needed at this point or that it will be efficiently used. And I do think, you know, Matt, you mentioned the idea that there might be a boom after coronavirus, and I think that is quite likely. But that boom is being used to justify the debt acquisition now. People are saying it's okay. We can, you know, just give all of this aid, and then we're going to grow our way out of it in the big boom that follows. And there's just this kind of simple math, which is like the more we borrow now, the harder it will be to grow our way out of it. Like, we should not just borrow infinitely unless your theory is truly that debt doesn't matter at all. And there certainly are some people at this point out there who are saying that. But of course, we're also lumping in student debt. We're also lumping in eviction moratoria. We're also lumping in all manner of new regulations, subsidies, etc., vaguely under the theory that this is coronavirus related, when in fact, these are all items that were on the agenda before.
I mean, in fact, in the long term, there's an argument to be made that taking on this much debt right now, especially after, again, $4 trillion last year, that's a lot of money. That's like a whole year's worth of budget extra.
Like no Y axes on any graphs yeah. work anymore. Every graph had to be like,
I remember. Yeah,
right. So there's a real argument just quickly here that it's not just that this will help us with that this will provide a boom here in the next year. But in the long term, borrowing this much money right now runs a real risk of dragging the economy down and actually making the economy weaker over the next decade or two. There's a useful analysis of the Biden plan from the Penn Wharton budget model, which is one of these sort of wonky go-to reference points for analyzing fiscal effects and how they sort of interact with the larger economy. And what they basically say is, sure, if you put all this money into the economy, you will get a boost in gross domestic product of 0.6% in 2021. So that's this year. You will boost, like, you kind of can't help but boost the economy in the very short term. But the additional public debt resulting from the Biden plan would decrease GDP by 0.2% in 2022. So that's next year. That's real soon. And 0.3% in 2040, which means we would be looking at 20 years, two decades here, of less growth as a result of a plan like this.
Which is firmly consistent with the debt overhang scenarios that ultimately even left-wing economists at University of Massachusetts Amherst signed on to, the idea that when you have massive ongoing debt levels in a country, it reduces long-term economic growth for as much as 25 years in typical episodes. I, you know, one of the things to consider too is that, like, you know, the puniness then of people who are saying essentially there is no reason to limit how much money we spend, et cetera. And they are like Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. They have this immense power and they're laying sausages on the Pope's nose. Like, where are the bold things that would withstand, you know, that would be around after the economy crashed? I can remember writing when George Bush left office, you know, that among other things, he broke the bank. I mean, he, you know, the massive increase in spending, he made LBJ look like a piker. And we had nothing to show for that massive amount of increase in spending, you know, 50% in real terms in the federal budget over everything. And all
we had a recession.
Were two gaping wounds. Yeah, we had two gaping wounds in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then a sluggish economy that led into, you know, one of the biggest economic crises in American history. You know, the idea, Peter, when you were saying, like, you know, they can't even say, okay, we're going to do Medicare for all, or we're going to do good medicine for all. It's amazing, and I think that's telling that people realize this is a political maneuver. It's not based on the economy. It's not based on helping people in need. It is just kind of pure power being played for immediate gain.
Can we have a brief pause to appreciate the Larry Summers role in all this? I mean, he was canceled so far before it was cool. Like, do y'all remember? Like, he might
I've forgotten the details of it.
He might have been like the OG canceled guy. I mean, he said some stuff about ladies in STEM in an off the record meeting that was supposed to be like a brainstorming session and then just got like boom, canceled, but also like not canceled at all. Like he was still like a full professor at Harvard or whatever. And
yep.
And he's still, you know, he's still like writing these things in the Washington Post and just kind of, but I do like that maybe he was always like this, but like he does not care whether you like Larry Summers. Like the depths of his lack of caring about whether Larry Summers has any friends, there's something a little bit appealing about that. Now, I think he was always kind of a jerk, so there
just
is that.
Just to not accept that there's anything good to say about Larry Summers, he did about a year or two ago wrote an op-ed about when him and his wife drove from like Minneapolis due west through Montana, and he was like, do you know they serve coffee at gas stations in this country?
No,
and I mean it was like, you know, E.T. or Kevin Spacey's K-Pax.
This is
or
such
something.
A Nick,
you know,
this guy thing had, like, to hold to get like one no, of the but, greatest I mean, economic he, minds of our time.
He's not like if you don't know that like gas stations serve a wide variety of beverages, and you know that America is a big country. My God, who knew? And this guy was president of Harvard and more importantly was secretary of
Man,
Treasury.
Just wait till he finds out
you know,
about
it's
Wawa.
Like, you know, come on, like get a grip.
Chicken cheesesteaks.
I mean, Einstein couldn't tie his shoelaces or whatever. We got to specialize sometimes, Nick.
Yeah, I can say having edited his quote columns, unquote, at the LA Times, during which time I never once communicated with him that he surrounds himself with...
yes, men and flunkies.
His reputation for unpleasantness creates a circle around him that also exudes such things. That's my
but
friendly
I think
way.
We should maybe note that it's not just Larry Summers. The media version of this story has taken on a Larry Summers versus the world quality. But when Olivier Blanchard is weighing in here to say, maybe this is too much. After being the sort of the figurehead for the seems like we should just borrow a lot more movement over the past couple of years, that's really telling. And it's notable, I think, that Biden was so dismissive of a package put together by Senate Republicans that was a little more than $600 billion. Now, you can say here on this podcast, wait, maybe that sounds like way too much after $4 trillion last year, but it's actually responsive to kind of centrist, you know, conventional estimates, macroeconomic estimates of what they call the output gap, right? Sort of basically the hole that the economy is going to be in over the next year or so, and it attempts to target relief towards the people who need relief. And so this is something you mentioned, Nick, is that folks making between about $50,000 and $150,000 for their households haven't really seen, on average, significant, meaningful declines in income. Personal savings rates are way up. And, you know, if you look at this crisis, it's kind of unusual in shape because it has almost exclusively hit low-wage younger workers who work in the kind of service and hospitality industry broadly defined. And by some measures, if you look at the rest of the economy, the part of the economy that doesn't basically rely on getting a whole bunch of people into a room together to like breathe on each other and have a drink, if you look at the rest of the economy, it's running at something that sort of looks like full employment. It's just this one part of the economy, not coincidentally, the part that a lot of state governors just forcibly shut down a year ago. It looks like that part of the economy is where the struggle is. And yet we have this help, you know, this relief package that is designed to, as Biden says, help people in need. But it's just, it's money for everyone. It's not money for people in need. It is, I mean, it's, again, when Jen Psaki last week was asked about this, in a White House press briefing, she was asked about the difference between, you know, the Biden plan, $1.9 trillion, and the Republican plan, $600 billion. And she said, well, you know, the president has some bottom lines. That was a phrase she used. He believes a married couple, let's say they're in Scranton, just for the sake of argument, one working as a nurse, the other one as a teacher. Nice choices there of employment. Making $120,000 a year, those people should get the $1,400 check that is that's part of this package. $120,000 a year, two stable incomes, you haven't lost your job. Those people are not the people who are hurting as a result of this.
Right? In Scranton,
where the median income is something like $41,000 for a two-earner, for a household, right? So they're making three times the median income. The median house price in Scranton is something like $120,000. That's the difference between the Biden plan and the Republican plan. That's what they are fighting to preserve. Now, I should be clear here, and then I will shut up. Biden has said that the one thing that he's willing to negotiate on in this is the income threshold. So they might bump down not the amount of the check, but the annual income of the couples and individuals who get the check. And so it might end up being merely couples that make $99,000 rather than $120,000.
You know, it would have been great in the inauguration if Biden, when he flashed his Rolex watch, if he said, you know, this watch, I could do so much more, and that he could sell the watch and then help somebody in need.
Talk about watchmen.
My father gave me this watch.
It's like a gift of the Magi problem, no problem.
Catherine?
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to talk. There are other things besides the macro size, the number and such, that are of significance that the Biden administration is rolling out and we're talking about rolling out. You've been looking a little bit about the debt forgiveness issue. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, this is just some classic crazy pantsness going on right now. And I will say to start out, Biden seems to be a moderating and civilizing force in this debate, which I didn't necessarily see coming, but there it is. Biden has said consistently throughout the campaign and then continued to say into the start of his administration, hey, if we're going to do student debt forgiveness, Congress should do it. I think it should be about $10,000 a person. Now, that's the moderate position at this point. The position that progressives in Congress are pushing, along with Chuck Schumer, who just seems to have like noticed a camera and was like, what are we advocating as usual, is $50,000 for each person, up to $50,000, and that it be done by executive order. This
God.
Is the most Sorry. Perfect encapsulation of how we are doing stuff in this country right now. The president is like, I think that Congress should do it, and maybe it should be like sort of middle-sized. And Congress is like, it should be huge, and the president should do it just by signing a paper. And this is everything. This is everything that we are doing right now. And it sucks, especially sucks because this is the worst possible way to deal with the crisis that this country is facing right now. It is A, not a good way to deal with the student loan debt crisis in isolation, right? We have about $1.6 trillion in student debt. It's a disaster, but retroactively forgiving everyone a ton of debt is absolutely the wrong way to do it. At the very minimum, there should be some kind of means test. which no one is talking about, or at least no one is seriously talking about. No one has written into anything plausible because, in fact, this is not about trying to stimulate the economy or help people who are genuinely in need. It's about fulfilling one of the bugaboos that dates at least back to the Occupy Wall Street movement and maybe even further, that somehow American students were tricked into taking on debt to fund their educations. Now, Reason has done a bunch of great work about how the incentives on student loans are really bad. They have shaped bad behavior, and that Pell Grants are part of the problem, as well as the subsidized loans. It was made worse by drawing student loans into the federal government rather than letting private lenders play a role. We have done everything wrong, and now we are going to do more things wrong just for the sake of, I don't know, under the name of economic stimulus. These are people who, as Nick just pointed out, are doing actually quite well. People who carry student loan debt, by and large, are people who are still employed during this pandemic. Not 100%, but like doing much better economically than almost every other group of people. And the fact that no one even wants to be the guy to do it is infuriating. I hate it. I wish it would go away. It absolutely will not. It's only going to get worse. And to be clear, Ilhan Omar said at the press conference about the call for $50,000 in debt relief, this is the first step toward full cancellation. So even if we did the thing, even if Joe Biden signed the paper and forgave $50,000 in debt from the people who in many ways need it the least, then we would not be done. It would not be over.
Nick, you mentioned earlier that we never have anything to show for all this fancy money that we spend. This was a common refrain during the Obama administration. He would always say, we used to build the Golden Gate Bridge, which, of course, is misreads the history of the Golden Gate Bridge, which had a lot of private financing. However, there's something true to that, as well as, you know,
we do need more bridges to nowhere. Isn't that?
I seem to
remember that phrase floating around the political
scene. If we brought
those
back, it would fix Congress, I hear.
Yeah.
Earmarks. We need them.
Matt? There's a button here that's not just a Diet Coke silencing button, but it's an active, like at least a paintball machine. Just pointing.
I think your family has a reverse Matt Lauer button on your basement office door, so you're not allowed out for like another 90 minutes.
Be honest,
you got nowhere to go, Matt.
That's the least terrifying interpretation of the phrase reverse Matt Lauer.
But this is also the notion that we don't ever have anything to show for. It also comes up in the context of New York City transportation or the subway. Like they opened their first new subway like stop in 40 years a year or so ago. Like they build nothing and they spend all of this money. And consistent with what Catherine just talked about, I'm beginning to believe in my increasingly rancid middle age that government is a wealth transfer machine to favored constituencies. It's a suspicion that's coming up.
Do you need me to acknowledge that as truth or?
No, the higher education.
We welcome you to Cracker Box Palace, Matt Welch. We've been expecting you.
I love that.
We have nothing to show for it. I mean, at least give everybody who wants them tattoos, you know, because like we are, you know, we're on a Coke binge and we don't know if we're at 3 a.m. or 6 a.m. and, you know, and dawn is breaking or we're still in the middle of the night. But it's, you know, we're going to wake up from this. And what will we have to show for it other than a massive amount of debt and a deviated septum? You know, whatever the analogy is for the country. We, you know, I mean, like at least buy some interesting crap, but we can't because, you know, one of the other things to kind of piggyback on what Catherine is talking about, and I would only add to her, you know, succinct analysis of the student loan crisis is that there is no crisis there because the student loan debt, by and large, is completely manageable by the people who took it out. The large number is big. And the real problem with it is that we are not addressing how it inflates college costs beyond what they should be. College is worth paying for because it gives you a premium in wages, you know, that is unmistakable and undeniable. But the way we are helping people pay for college makes college even more expensive than it should be. What I'm talking about is high-speed rail. Because for me, this is the golden hour of Joe Biden, and it kind of is a secret key into what a piece of junk he is as a president. He is a warmed over corpse, you know, from the last 50 years. And I, when I was looking at, you know, Pete Buttigieg has been hitting the talk shows to talk about how, you know what, this time we mean it, man. America is going to be number one in the world in high speed rail. And literally 11 years ago, Joe Biden had become the high-speed rail czar for Barack Obama, and this was a bold initiative. We were going to make, you know, America the number one, you know, with a bullet train, high-speed rail country in the world. And of course, it came to nothing because high-speed rail is almost everywhere and always a super boondoggle, especially when it's publicly subsidized or publicly run. And if you go back and look, they were talking 10 years ago. Joe Biden was talking about how, you know, what they're doing in California is fantastic. They're building a high-speed rail line from San Francisco to L.A. That'll get you there a little bit slower than if you freaking flew, you know? And
it's competitive,
of course,
with City Bike.
With all, with all of the with all of the subsidies, with the complete backing of two California governors who were balls deep in, you know, choo-choo train love like teenage or adolescent boys, pre-adolescent boys, it went nowhere.
No.
And the cost ballooned. And that's the future of high-speed rail. But Joe Biden is back, baby. And this time, you know, we're going to have high-speed rail from what, Tampa Bay to Orlando or something? You know, I mean, it's mind-numbing. And this is what worries me the most about the Biden administration. In many ways, it is a retread. It's almost, I mean, he won fair and square. He won election, unlike Gerald Ford. But this is an administration where either the people or the ideas are both are retreads from failures in the recent past.
You know what is, you know, worth saying?
It's very dispiriting.
Vaccine production. And the fact that we have spent $4 trillion and are contemplating nearly $2 trillion more, and the portion of that that was spent on buying and setting up production facilities, it's not maybe completely too late now, but it's somewhat too late to sort of go back and do this. A lot of this would have needed to be done in June or July of last year to really make a difference right now. But the fact that we have spent so little on vaccine production, right? We should be paying for facilities to produce these things that are far in excess of like what the market would normally sort of want, right? Because there's just an incredible economic and human toll every single day that we don't have more jabs, sorry, Catherine, more jabs in arms. And yes, the new relief plan does include a bunch of money for distribution, for getting states set up to put jabs in arms. But we just sort of missed the ball, I think. I mean, Operation Warp Speed spent a couple of billion dollars, right? Not a tiny amount of money, but also not nearly enough. And those production facilities should have just been scaled up in parallel to the maximum extent, and literally any amount of money that we had spent on that to even just get twice as many vaccines in arms in December or January would have probably been worth it.
Let's table a conversation for a moment. We're going to be talking about soon our listener question of the week and maybe get a little bit more in Biden administration policies. But first, look, February is rough. This February, above all others, if you are one of the millions of people out there suffering in these trying times from depression, stress, anxiety, sleeplessness, please consider seeking out BetterHelp.com/roundtable. BetterHelp.com. That's H-E-L-P, like what Tom Brady gets from referees. Gives you instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals from coast to coast. Go to their website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and needs, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. Don't like that person? You can switch them out. Financial assistance is also available. That is BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. I'm just going to add in the litany of Biden administration stuff and policies, one that's going to be rolled out this week in more detail. There's a big piece on it in NPR this morning that raised my hackles. And that is the piece of the relief package aimed at K-12 schools. $130 billion aimed at K through 12 schools. Why are you?
Just like $130 billion. That used to be like a significant part of a budget proposal.
Now it's
like, oh God, like that. I mean, you can't even get out of the driveway with $130 billion, Matt.
We spend.
You can't buy enough kickballs. You know,
the federal government generally spends about $40 billion per year on K through 12. We've already spent $70 billion extra on during the previous trillions of relief package stuff to on K through 12. Be mindful of the following. There is a tremendous, in my, again, increasingly rancid point of view, a bait and switch going on here in which people like Randy Weingarten, who's the president of the American Federation of Teachers, is being portrayed by the New York Times and other easily duped institutions as like being the person who's really fighting to, you know, reopen schools. What she's fighting for. What Joe Biden is fighting for, regardless of what he says this week about reopening schools, he's fighting to spend $130 billion on a preferred interest group with no necessarily strings attached to them. The bulk of the $130 billion, they've been breaking it down. It's not for ventilation and all the stuff that they say that they need. Most of it, like $60 billion, is to prevent layoffs. $14 billion for extra like custodians and janitors, which absolutely are not needed because you don't stop the disease by wiping down more stuff. We knew that. We knew that like in July, maybe June, that it wasn't. That remember we used to wipe down our groceries and we don't do that anymore. They want to spend your money to wipe down desks. That is not at this point necessary. In addition to. And they want to hire more counselors. They want to do this, that. They want to hire more staff. So at a time when the enrollment in K through 12 schools is down by around 5%, possibly more, and I can testify as someone who it might send my youngest daughter to private school, which is something I never contemplated ever come in the fall. There's a lot of people who might stay out permanently from the public education system to decide that that is a time for a federal hiring spree in the public education system without any strings attached to them is amazing to behold. It is amazing. And in addition to all of that money, that the majority of which is just for personnel, so straight to teachers union, you know, members, there's also in the relief package $350 billion earmarked towards helping states stabilize their budgets. Important to realize what that means. It's a just like, you know, public transportation in New York City, stabilizing budget means making sure that you can pay your public employees and their pensions. And 20% or so of state budgets on average goes to K through 12 education. So what we're doing is much like in the 2008 and 2009 bailout slash stimulus at the time, we are backfilling state public pension packages that are, for the most part, defined benefit and not defined contribution. And it's not going to make things safer. And meanwhile, almost most of the private schools around the country are open without all this fancy taxpayer money and extra billions of dollars. Weird that. Catherine, just say something that shows how much you hate all of us.
I can't. I'm dead inside. I'm broken by it. I'm so mad. The thing that I hate the most is the public school teachers getting in the front of the line for vaccination. And that's a part of this, too, that they are in the front of the line for vaccination, but also refusing to promise to be back in classrooms, even in the fall, in some places like Fairfax County here in the D.C. area. Meanwhile, the schools have hired other non-teacher humans to be in the classroom, but they do not have priority for vaccination, nor do the private school teachers who have been teaching in classrooms all along. I can't even. I cannot. That's what I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you.
Teachers, I mean, you know, you got to give them a break because when I read, you know, what I read in the paper and hear on cable and stuff like that is that teachers are not only not paid well, they actually pay to teach.
They
go to school, they spend, you know, thousands of their own dollars. They make $60,000 a year on average around the country. That's just full of lies.
Of teachers, they are working really hard this year. This is the other way the union failed them. Like, the union, by trying to protect their health misguidedly in the first phase of the pandemic, wound up making them all have to relearn how to teach in new ways, on new platforms, to no particular end, as far as we can tell, health-wise. Like, the union screwed the teachers, too, but they screwed me the most.
Let's go to our annual. It's not annual. It's every show. I don't know what the words are.
Weekly? Is that the word you were looking for?
Weekly, thank
you. Did you lose the word weekly, Grandpa?
I lost it.
Uh-oh.
It's not fortnightly. Regular, routine. Anyways, we always answer your questions. Or we, every week,
quarter,
we answer.
Monthly?
You try to get Alan Quartermain back in this, Nick, and I'm just not going to have it. We answer questions from you, our super smart listeners. Those questions can be sent to us via the following two methods. One is email at roundtable@reason.com or by voicemail, 213-973-3017. I love it. It's a 213 number. That's what I grew up with, man. In either format, please mention how you would like to be identified and if you have a social media presence that you want to hype. Okay. Today's email comes from Hampton. Good name. In Denver. It goes a little something like this. As you may have heard this week, McKinsey settled with 47 state attorneys general, well done on the pluraling there, for $560 million as punishment for advice that it gave Purdue Pharma. This on top of the $6 billion in judgments against Purdue itself, which they will likely not pay as they are in bankruptcy. The distribution and marketing of regulated opioids by pharma companies, which to me is a similar outcome to what could happen with full drug legalization, resulted in huge medical costs to states, real harm to many communities, and punitive legal repercussions for the companies involved in manufacturing or even advising the drugs. Maybe it's meant advertising. This latest outcome from the opioid epidemic has made me question some of my priors about ending the war on drugs. Specifically this, can societies handle legal opioids, or is it a bridge too far? Nick, you're up to your earballs in psychedelics. Are you ready for big pharma?
I thought you were going to say in skag, Matt, which is what we briefly called heroin on a couple of TV shows in the late 70s, early 80s.
I love the we in that.
It's the royal we.
Are you ready for big pharma to supply your psychedelics, Nick Gillespie?
That's a kind of interesting question. I think it's going to look, all kinds of, as drugs become more legal, and I should point to the fact that the latest issue of Reason has a whole bunch of stories, including one by me, about the coming legalization of magic mushrooms and other types of plant-based, as well as lab-created pharmaceutical hallucinogens, psychedelics, whatever. And it's a really great resource to look through. And I will also point out that I, on the recent interview with Nicholas with a podcast that drops every Wednesday, I spoke within the past few weeks to Sally Satel, a psychiatrist, a medical doctor who spent a year in Ironton, Ohio, dealing with opioid problems in Appalachian, Ohio. And she argues that Purdue Pharma is liable for mismarketing and pushing things, but she says that their drug reps were pushing on open doors when they came to overprescribe in places like the Midwest, Appalachia, Northern Maine, and whatnot. And I also more recently talked with Carl Hart, who's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University, who in his fantastic book, Drug Use for Grownups, comes out as a recreational heroin user. And he talks about heroin in particular, or opioids, that you get between a 10% to 30% range of abuse that would be classified as addiction under current medical or psychiatric definitions. That's about the same. That upper limit is the same as lifetime problems with alcohol use disorder. And he says, you know, that overwhelmingly people who use heroin or people who use opioids do not develop abusive relationships with those substances. That's in the background. Check out those podcasts. To this question more specifically, can societies handle legal opioids or is it a bridge too far? We can also look at places like Portugal, which decriminalized all drugs and all narcotics for personal use. And what they saw, and I think this is what we would see in America, is that there would be a period perhaps of increased use when everything becomes legalized or decriminalized. As information flows better and as people understand things more, there would be a societal learning curve, and we would see fewer problem use rates in America as we see in Portugal. There's no question, I think, there would be a bunch of people trying it first off, but then eventually people would develop the habits, they would have the information that they trust, they would have more reliable drugs, because with opioids, generally speaking, it's not the opioid itself or heroin itself. It's the adulterants, including things like fentanyl, that really screw things up. It is better to have these things out in the open, especially for people with abuse. I'm fond of saying, you know, and I say this as somebody who doesn't drink anymore because I'm bad when I drink. I'm not a good drinker. If you tell somebody you are an addict or you have an abuse problem, that's tough enough to get help. If you tell them, oh, and on top of that, you're a criminal, that's two bridges too far. I think it's better to legalize and have honest discussions about what responsible use looks like.
All right, let's go to our end of show, what you have been consuming. Peter, since he's going to say something I'm going to disagree with, why don't you go first?
I watched The Weeknd perform the Super Bowl halftime show, which is just a sentence that even 2019 me, but certainly like 2011 me, cannot believe is like journalistically accurate. That the guy who was this like anonymous internet like marauder of like weird neo R&B back in 2011 and 2012, releasing free EPs, not telling anybody his actual name. And these albums were just, I mean, like, remarkably well-crafted and also remarkably sociopathic, just in sort of their tone, their approach, like, their subject matter, all of this stuff. And now this guy is, like, doing, like, a goofy lounge act at the Super Bowl, and I don't know how to process it. And apparently, my understanding is that a lot of the reason he's at the Super Bowl is because of TikTok. And one of the songs on his new album that came out a year ago or so just became like a dance craze on TikTok, that like the intro to the song was a meme, and then the whole song broke like every Spotify and single record that exists and all of this. And since I'm not on TikTok and I don't do the dancing in any way or shape or form, I just don't. Brain does not comprehend dancing, can't at all. Like it just completely breaks my ability to.
You can't even talk about it. Yeah.
And I'm just. He's dancing right now. It's a fascinating kind of transformation in terms of, you know, how he has moved from being this really edgy, really dark pop culture force to being kind of a joke for tweens on the internet? I don't know.
My tween on the internet, that was the only thing that she was at all excited about with the Super Bowl. Granted, we don't have a much of a sports watching family aside from the patriarch. But she was just, you know, just keep groaning, Nick. No, she was super excited about The Weeknd for precisely that. She's a TikTok aficionado and participant, and couldn't wait for the big one song to come on, and declared herself very happy.
I thought the whole House of Balloons EP like straight. That was my hope, because it's so dark and so weird. And I like some of his new stuff. More or less, it's pretty good for what it is. But the original three EPs, which have been recombined into a single album that's sort of overlong, are really just remarkable kind of textural musical experiences, right? And we had an argument on the internet about his voice, Matt, and you were arguing he's not a great singer. And I think the point is, it's not that he's a good singer or a bad singer. It's that his voice is an interesting instrument. It's often mixed really low in the mix, especially in his early work. And you just get these incredible, weird sort of sonic textures and landscapes, right? And so if you listen to music kind of primarily for it as a, if you like music production and sort of music as soundscape, his early work is so incredible and so not like obviously commercial in so many ways. So again, it's just really weird to see that kind of persona, but also that kind of music make its way to the Super Bowl and to the sort of the biggest, what is now the biggest forum in pop music in the space of a decade.
I'm a big fan of Super Bowl entertainers who are really good singers and performers.
Oh.
So that's where my
Can we admit that the Super Bowl halftime show died with Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake?
No, we can't. I mean, because Prince was afterwards, great. And last year was great. Actually, Jennifer Lopez and Shakira, and Jennifer Lopez, you know, music is neither here nor there. But
haven't stopped moving since Matt Welch. And
she was great.
Bruce Springsteen had a good Super Bowl halftime show. But
no, he
that
did
element
not,
of
sir.
Danger, that element of danger that was introduced first by the guy floating down in the jetpack, which was obviously burning the lower third of his body, you know, beyond redemption. But then the Janet Jackson thing, and that's what Prince brought more than anybody. I mean, yes, The Weeknd had people wearing jock straps on their head, which is always interesting and exciting.
Yes.
But you want that threat level, which Prince brought, because everybody was knowing he was going to do some kind of weird thing, which he did to contravene the censors. But I want the danger.
I much prefer her, H-E-R, with the dots, who did American the Beautiful before, and she was great, and she looked really cool too. Nick, what did you consume?
I consumed the Sam Levinson Netflix movie, which was also released in, you know, whatever theaters and private schools are open over the weekend, but it was mostly on Netflix, Malcolm and Marie, and it stars John David Washington and Zendaya, who started out as a songstress, but is now better known as an actress on Euphoria, which is also a Sam Levinson production. And it
also in the Spider-Man movie.
Yes, that's right. For sure. This is an interesting movie. It's two people, a couple, a movie director and his muse and partner coming home after the premiere of his latest film, which is finally a success. He's in his late 30s, as is Levinson. The Malcolm and Marie are black, and they complain about various things, mostly about each other, but also the film industry. And it is a
and film critics.
Film critics, yeah. But also, yes. It is a good movie. It's as no things are perfect. I think it's a really interesting kind of meditation, both on relationships and where people draw inspiration, as well as the function of criticism, where movies are. An interesting argument in it is that if you are a black artist, your work has to be political, whether you want it to be or not, or even if your political statement is to say, I don't want to make a political statement right now. A lot to think about. The movie, which is very interestingly shot, it's about an hour and 40 minutes long. You know, I would have edited it slightly differently, but it was captivating. It's raw. It is very uncomfortable to watch if you're not used to living in relationships that are very much like George Costanza's parents on Seinfeld. Fantastic stuff. And now a lot of the chatter online is like, how does Sam Levinson, who's the son of Barry Levinson, a Hollywood legend in his own right, you know, where does he get off having black actors say his lines, et cetera, which just shows you how quickly people want to evacuate any kind of serious argument and immediately put it into context where they can dismiss things or not actually have meaningful conversation. But Malcolm and Marie, highly
also kind of that argument, I think, really eliminates or, you know, not, I mean, comes close to kind of erasing Zendaya's role in not just in saying the lines, but in helping to conceive the movie. And the origin story for this movie is that the production on Euphoria got shut down and she was like, I'm going to go stir crazy. Can you write me something that we can produce during the pandemic? And so they went through a bunch of ideas and came onto this one. And she was really instrumental in at least in developing the concept and the character, but reportedly also in literally writing a bunch of these lines. And John David Washington came in later. Interestingly, this was the first movie that finished production during the pandemic under Los Angeles's extremely strict rules and guidelines, and they had to go through all the sort of union reps and all of this. I just think it's a really interesting movie kind of for our purposes in how much it is focused on criticizing journalists and film and critics in particular, and basically saying you don't know the thing you're writing about. And what you do instead is use these really easy, cheap political tropes as crutches just to kind of get around having to actually know your subject matter and to interrogate it in a useful way. And it is just a fascinatingly spiteful response to bad criticism in a way that I think is not always entirely successful, but fascinatingly interesting and really, really remarkably well-crafted.
I don't disagree with you. And what this, although it's also true that this is a very old kind of trope among directors of like, oh, my critics are idiots. Listening to or watching this, I was reminded there's a whole slate of progressive rock albums from the 70s where, you know, the big 18-minute long overture, you know, at the end is about the critics who they don't do anything. They can't play instruments and they just take down the great rock gods, you know, whoever, an ELP or Todd Rundgren or whatever, you know, these are little men who are dragging me down. There's something to that. But what this movie does is, and I think this, we need to be fully in participatory culture where you don't have to either agree or disagree with the director or the targets of the criticism. Like it's a conversation starter. And I do think Levinson is particularly interesting because in Euphoria, the show, the HBO show that has Zendaya on it, which is fantastic. And there are two special episodes of that were released in December and January of this year, which were very collaborative. And if you watch the behind the scenes shows about that, he's an incredibly openly collaborative filmmaker, script writer, and things like that. And it's a great model. And it blows apart, you know, the idea that, oh, you know, here, you know, these black actors are just ventriloquist dummies for this privileged white guy's, you know, second generation Hollywood royalty, blah, blah, blah. We need a different framework to be talking about how creativity and meaning is produced. And I think this movie is a good entry into that.
I think Zendaya is great. Catherine, what did you consume?
So I got kind of Instagram lured into watching the new documentary, which I guess I was trying to figure out who made this thing. It appears to be a Hulu FX New York Times collaboration.
Like things are now.
Which is like, I guess, how the world is now, called Framing Britney Spears. And it's about her experience with conservatorship, which I knew a little bit about, but there is kind of a whole cluster of people on the internet, the Free Britney movement, who are concerned that this woman who is, she's my age, she's, you know, I think she's in her 40s at this point, and she still is under the total, both personal and financial control of court-ordered conservatorship until recently, her father on both counts. And it's actually a really interesting documentary, I think, for libertarians, especially for those of us who have a little bit of interest in kind of the Thomas Sazian tradition of where mental illness and state control overlap. Because we don't know exactly what's up with Britney, at least according to this documentary. And to be clear, there's no new information in this documentary. They did not get access. They do not have new records. It's just talking heads. But it is a pretty good summary of the ways in which a legal provision that is written to be used primarily for older relatives or very young children who genuinely have no, you know, diminished mental capacity and are not likely to get it back, or for very temporary purposes, has been used for years now on this woman who seems to be pretty high functioning. Like, maybe she's not making the best choices, but she's not self-evidently, you know, vegetative or out of her mind or anything like that. It has kept her away from her children. It has kept her hands off of her, I think, like $60 million fortune. And it's a troubling story. The thing that I was struck by when I was watching it is it's a conspiracy theory that's probably true. You know, conspiracy theories are something that we're talking about a lot these days. But there's a small group of people who put together the pieces and said, like, hey, I think this grown lady who's like kind of fine is sort of being held prisoner by her father and the state. Let's discuss. I was pretty convinced by this and then what I went online and read afterward. That something ain't right, and that this is at the very least a story of what happens when the state assumes significant powers over you know, your most private decisions and hands them to someone else, and that should be subject to incredibly high levels of scrutiny, and in many cases is, but you know, paradoxically hasn't been here in the case of a highly scrutinized person. So if you have any interest in that kind of Sazian issue of where the state and sanity intersect, it was actually a pretty nicely put together documentary and short. It's like an hour or something.
I flew cross country, and since someone else was paying for my nice tickets, I had a nice screen and headphones and watched five movies that I hadn't seen before, including The Blues Brothers. I'd never seen The Blues Brothers.
How many made you cry? How much crying?
What?
The Blues Brothers.
You've never seen The Blues Brothers?
No, Matt.
Welch, why are we even talking to you?
Because I, unlike most people, do not have a sense of shame about admitting what I haven't seen.
Very
and I
good.
Will and I will see them and fill
humility.
In the blanks. And
inspiring.
not at all care for the snortings of my colleagues and other people.
Cognizant. Boy, that's Henry Gibson as you've never seen him before, Matt. Welch.
I honestly didn't
in
know
the
that
Blues Brothers.
I didn't know that there was a Skokie Nazi angle to the Blues Brothers. So it was,
that's
it was
like
great.
The whole thing.
It's a great reveal. No, the one that I want to talk about is not the Blues Brothers and not Tenet, although I just will add parenthetically
that temporal pincer movement, Matt.
The temporal pincer movement.
Much to talk about, temporal pincer.
Is that Kenneth Branagh, it's not Kenneth Branagh, that's Thaddeus Russell. And that's only when it begins to make sense. The movie all hangs, like, oh, that's Thad. It just now, finally, it makes sense. No, the movie I want to talk about is one, it's the one of the most powerful movie experiences I've had since God knows when, 1917. It was amazing to me. Movie Sam Mendes came out last year, the year before, whatever. Got a lot of attention because like half of it is a tracking shot, which is crazy, and it's all about
the
these
the
two
whole
guys
thing is stitched together to look like one single shot. There's a bunch of obvious tricks to do that. I guess you're right. There's one.
There's
real
a break.
Cut.
There's a
real
break.
Cut.
But like I just. Sucked me in from the beginning and absolutely riveting would you fucking stop sighing at me during a podcast, please? Seriously, I don't want to hear you sigh and snort and make man noises while I'm talking.
Nick is really sighing at himself, Matt.
It's a good movie. Go watch it. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable podcast. We'll get back to you next week. Reason.com/podcast for all of our offerings. Goodbye.
Shot by Roger Deakins.